Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm going to be reading articles that were published by the Geographic Society in the October-November 2024 time frame. So I hope you enjoy the program. We're going to begin with this article from the science section, Can a Human Outrun a Horse? Here's what it takes. Nicole Tini's legs felt like lead, her lungs burning with each breath as she approached the final stretch of a 50-mile ultra-marathon. Fatigue gnawed at her, but she knew she couldn't slow down. Her competitors were right behind her. But these weren't ordinary runners. Tini was racing against horses, a journey detailed in ESPN's new 4-episode Girl vs. Horse podcast series. For the 35-year-old, this race marked the pinnacle of a 5-year journey to accomplish something seemingly impossible. Race a horse and win. As she approached the finish line, my body was on autopilot, she says. I knew that if I stopped, it would be difficult to keep going. But she did keep going. She kept pushing, and when she crossed that 50-mile mark, she had done it. She beat a horse. While Tini isn't the first person to outrun a horse, Welsh marathoner Hugh Loeb holds that title, her achievement was anything but guaranteed. Tini had grown up running, but 5 years prior she was diagnosed with epilepsy. This condition had sidelined her running career as she struggled to find the proper medication to control her seizures. For Tini, this race wasn't just about endurance. It was about reclaiming control over her body and testing the limits of her physical and mental strength. But still, how is it that Tini, or any human, has ever stood a chance against a horse? Why humans are built for long-distance running. Tini's quest to outrun a horse began after her epilepsy diagnosis. She stumbled upon a chapter in Born to Run that introduced her to endurance running hypotheses. This theory, popularized by Harvard paleontologist David Lieberman, suggests that humans evolved to run long distances, thanks to adaptations like short toes, long legs, and upright posture. Almost every system in the body is adapted to help us run, Lieberman says. He adds that our cardiovascular systems are uniquely efficient at delivering oxygen to muscles, especially compared to other primates. And maybe more importantly, humans are better than most animals at shedding heat due to our unique ability to sweat, Lieberman says. The hypothesis posits that we developed these traits, at least partly because our hominoid ancestors practiced persistence hunting, chasing prey until it was too exhausted to continue. An antelope could easily outrun a human over short distances, but the tables turn over long distances, Lieberman says. Running might also have had something to do with how our brains evolved. David Raichelin, a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina, says that running can make us better at cognitive tasks, improve cognition, relieve anxiety, and even protect us from neurodegenerative diseases. From an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense, Raichelin says. It's a more naturalistic setting. Oftentimes, we're trying to find food, and that requires a combination of being physically active and using your brain. Running also causes our brain to release opioids and endocannabinoids, which are likely what contributes to the so-called runner's high. These chemicals might have made it more appealing for our hominoid ancestors to expend energy and could be a big part of our motivation to run and push past pain, Raceland says. Not everyone buys into the endurance running hypothesis, though. Running expends much more energy than walking, and only a handful of modern-day societies still practice endurance hunting. We can say that humans are meant for endurance exercise, says Alexandra Coates, a postdoctoral fellow at Simon Fraser University and triathlete. She adds, however, that walking is more efficient than running, and that we likely evolved to walk for long distances, not run. Nicholas Tiller, a research associate at Lundquist Institute, Harbor UCLA Medical Center, also doubts that we evolved to run ultramarathon distances, mainly because of their potentially negative impacts on our health. Although all forms of exercise have a net benefit, extreme exercise, like ultramarathons, involves pushing our bodies to the limit. Studies show that ultramarathon running could potentially cause harm to organ systems, including the cardiovascular system, skeletal muscles, and kidneys. I still contest that our bodies evolved to withstand the rigor of an ultra-endurance event, Tiller says. Still, Lieberman maintains that running played some role in our evolution. Just this year, the endurance running hypothesis got some support from a study that used AI to comb through historical records to find reports of persistent hunting. The researchers found 400 separate ethnographic cases of endurance, pursuit-like hunting from around the world, an order of magnitude more than had previously been recorded. So while some researchers remain skeptical, Lieberman says that running was part of the mix. The psychological battle of ultra-endurance racing. Regardless of whether we evolve specifically to run, outrunning a horse is a more difficult challenge than persistence hunting. While most species aren't adapted for long-distance running, Coates says, horses are some of the best endurance runners in the animal kingdom. Outrunning one is a testament to human endurance and requires lots and lots of training. Luckily, our bodies are well adapted to make us better endurance runners. Once a person starts endurance-based training, Coates says, their body starts making changes that include their VO2 max, or the maximum rate at which their body can use oxygen. That means the number of mitochondria in their cells will grow. Capillaries will start sprouting in their heart and muscles to shuttle oxygen to their cells. They'll also develop more slow oxidative fibers, which contract slowly and use aerobic respiration more efficiently than other types of muscle. Over time, their heart size will increase, and their body composition will change to support more muscle. Training can only go so far, however. For many endurance athletes, a race is as much a mental exercise as a physical one, Tiller says. Even for marathoners, transitioning to a more extended ultra-marathon event presents a big psychological challenge. Tiller says that in reality, running an ultra-marathon is always going to be painful, and it's always going to be extremely damaging. But what gets you through the psychology is just that relentless kind of inability to give up. Indeed, studies suggest that ultra-running is often associated with a psychological drive to test one's limits. Motivation and goal-setting are key components of getting through a race for most ultra-marathoners. In addition, Research shows that internal states significantly impact race performance. Self-belief and positive self-talk are important factors in getting through a race. It takes a certain amount of harnessing your mind in addition to your body, Teeny says. And that's the end of the article. The title was, Can a Human Outrun a Horse? Here's What It Takes. And there was no author cited for the article. This article comes to us from the History and Culture section. 8 Things People Get Wrong About Ancient Rome by Parissa DeJangi. Ancient Rome maintains a grip on pop culture, from Hollywood blockbusters to video games. Since its establishment in 31 BC, the Roman Empire exerted its influence throughout the Mediterranean and beyond. But what if the Rome we think we know, complete with deadly arenas, decadence, and marble statues, is more fiction than fact? From not-so-deadly gladiator tournaments to the real purpose of the vomitorium, here's the truth behind 8 myths about ancient Rome. Myth number 1. Gladiators always fought to the death. In contrast to the kill or be killed depiction of gladiator combat in films, not every bout was a fight to the death. In his book, Naked Statues, Fat Gladiators, and War Elephants, historian Garrett Ryan estimated that gladiators died in only 1/5 of fights. It simply didn't pay to have fighters die in the arena. Dead gladiators couldn't earn money. Every death came at a financial loss to the lanista, or individual who owned, hired out, and maintained a gladiator troop. That's not to say gladiator fights were safe. They were a blood sport after all, and every battle could lead to severe injury and the dangerous infections that often accompanied them. Myth number 2. The vomitorium was a room where Romans purged after feasting. According to popular imagination, ancient Romans overindulged in lavish feasts. They ate so much that they had a special room in their villas where they could purge themselves before gorging again. The vomitorium. Vomitoria really existed, but they had nothing to do with emesis. Instead, the vomitorium was an architectural feature of amphitheaters and arenas. The space enabled spectators to enter and exit the structure efficiently. Myth number 3. Ancient Roman statues were meant to be white. Most people picture ancient statues as serene figures in smooth, white marble, but that colorless look is more accident than artistry. The Roman world was in living color, as were its busts and sculptures. Artists applied layers of vivid paint to their marble artwork to depict everything from skin tones to sideburns. The paint faded over time, giving sculptures their colorless appearance today. Myth number 4. Nero played the fiddle while Rome burned. Nero, who ruled from AD 54 to 68, is often remembered as one of the history's most notorious emperors, his reputation steeped in tales of excess and cruelty. One enduring myth claims that as a great fire devastated Rome in AD 64, he coldly played a fiddle while the city burned. It's a vivid image, but also a fictional one. The main sources describing Rome's great fire were written long after the event, meaning there were no eyewitnesses to confirm the infamous tale. Moreover, fiddles didn't even exist until the Middle Ages. In reality, Nero seems to have taken the fire seriously. He wasn't in the city when it started, but when news reached him, he raced back to Rome and did what he could, including trying to slow the flames and providing relief to those impacted. Myth number 5, Roman women were confined to the home. True, Rome was a patriarchal society, one in which women had fewer freedoms than men, were disenfranchised, and couldn't serve in public office. But that doesn't mean women were sequestered in their homes, far from public affairs. Instead, Roman women found ways to control their lives, like owning property. Julia Felix was one such woman, and she owned buildings and a bathhouse in Pompeii just before the city's destruction in AD 79. Though lacking legal rights, some women exerted influence over politics, especially the wives, sisters, and daughters of emperors and senators. They weren't the only ones. In 195 BC, women took the streets of Rome to protest the Lex Appia, a law that limited what they could wear. Myth number 6, everyone in the Roman Empire looked and spoke the same. At its peak in the 2nd century, the Roman Empire stretched from modern-day England to Turkey. It encompassed different people, cultures, and languages, including Aramaic, Greek, and Gaulish. People moved within the empire, too. In 1901, the remains of an elite Roman woman were discovered in York, England. Over a century later, an analysis of her skeleton enabled researchers to determine that she was likely of North African descent. She wasn't alone. Hadrian's Wall, commonly known as the border of Roman Britain, counted African soldiers as some of its troops operating it. Even emperors didn't always come from the Italian peninsula. Trajan was born in modern-day Spain, while Septimius Severus hailed from what is now Libya. Myth number 7. Early Christian martyrs were mainly slaughtered in the Colosseum. In the story of early Christianity, one chapter stands out, that martyrs were cruelly, brutally tortured and killed in the Colosseum. There simply isn't any historical evidence that this happened at the Colosseum. Instead, other venues in Rome, like the Circus Maximus and the provinces, had been the staging ground for some religious executions. Nonetheless, tales of martyrdom at the Colosseum cropped up in the 5th century, and by then Christianity had already been adopted as an official religion. By the 16th century, the Catholic Church had elevated the Colosseum to a sacred site, supposedly anointed by the spilled blood of the martyrs. Myth number 8. Rome fell in AD 476. According to the conventional story, the Roman Empire fell in the 5th century when the Germanic king Odoacer deposed Emperor Romulus Augustulus. It technically meant the end of the Roman Empire. In AD 330, the empire had split into two parts, the Western Empire based in Rome and the Eastern Empire based in Constantinople. Though Romulus Augustulus had been usurped in 476, Zeno, the emperor of the Eastern Empire, had not. This part of the empire survived as the Byzantine Empire for the next millennium. Some have argued that the fall of the Western Empire has been overstated, as historian Edward J. Watts points out in The Eternal Decline and Fall of Rome, The History of a Dangerous Idea. No one in Italy thought that Roman life had fundamentally shifted following Odoacer's arrival. All of the things that traditionally marked Rome as Roman continued. Indeed, much of Rome still endures in our infrastructure, our love of sport, our romance languages. And even as Rome has survived in surprising ways, these inaccurate, long-standing myths don't have to. That's the end of the article. The title was 8 Things People Get Wrong About Ancient Rome by Parissa DeJangi. This article's title is Polar Bears Live on Ice, But New Conditions Are Injuring Them. It's written by Kieran Mulvaney. Polar bears walk across sea ice for miles, searching for cracks and holes in the surface through which they can hunt their ringed seal prey. But a new study has found that in some areas, the ice on which they rely has been damaging their feet. Writing in the journal Ecology, ecologist Kristen Laudre of the University of Washington and wildlife biologist Stefan Atkinson of the Nunavut Department of the Environment found that bears in 2 of the most northerly populations, East Greenland and Kane Basin, between northeastern Canada and northwestern Greenland, had suffered lacerations, hair loss, skin ulcerations, and ice buildup on their fur, and primarily on their feet. In the most extreme examples, 2 bears had ice blocks up to 1 foot in diameter stuck to their foot pads, which caused deep bleeding cuts and made it difficult for them to walk. Atkinson first noticed lesions in bears in Kane Basin during a survey in the region in 2012 and 2013. He shared images with Laudre, but didn't yet know it was part of a trend. "We didn't really know what to think of it," she says. Then, during surveys of East Greenland between 2018 and 2022, Laudre began seeing the same injuries. The reason, the study's authors believe, is climate change, and their concern it could become yet another challenge for polar bears to adapt to. Hair loss and painful paws. Some bears have alopecia, or hair loss, on their bodies, presumably where balls of ice had become entangled in their fur and been ripped out. Laudre notes that by itself this isn't necessarily uncommon. Polar bears live in extreme environments where they can get ice buildup, she says. What made it notable, however, was the context, with most of the incidents of alopecia occurring on bears' feet. Many of the polar bears' paws they examined also displayed other serious wounds, including multiple bleeding ulcerations. They suspect the wounds were painful because the bears sometimes flinched when the wounds were gently touched, even though they were sedated. Finding bears with ice blocks on the soles of their feet was, says Laudre, totally shocking. From the air, she could tell that something was wrong with them because it appeared they couldn't walk very well. It wasn't until I was on the ground that I realized, of course, they couldn't walk, when I saw what was stuck to their feet. When she sedated the bears and examined their paws, she found that the blocks of ice were solid. It took 30 minutes of scraping away with metal tools to remove them. The total number of bears with some form of ice-related injury that Laudre and Atkinson identified between them was relatively small, 32 in Kane Basin and 15 in eastern Greenland. But that constituted 52% and 12% of all the bears that were studied, which is notable given that, Laudre says, such impacts had not previously been noted by scientists or by indigenous hunters, who were also interviewed for the study. "We didn't want to say this is something new without hearing what hunters had observed," Laudre explains. "The people who see polar bears the most are the people who live in communities alongside bears and hunt for subsistence, and most of the hunters we spoke to had not seen this before." Many did note, however, that they had seen something similar with their sled dogs, which sometimes also experienced painful ice buildup on their paws in slushy conditions. Is a warming Arctic to blame? Laudrey and Atkinson believe that a warming climate may have played a role. In their paper, they propose explanations for the injuries. Firstly, they note that as temperatures increase in the Arctic, precipitation is increasingly falling as rain instead of snow. And one scenario they envision is rainfall causing a slushy surface on the ice, which then freezes on the paws of polar bears that walk through it. Additionally, warming causes surface snow to melt and refreeze into a hard crust. And a second possibility is that bears' paws break through that crust and become cut on sharp edges. A third scenario helps explain why bears in these populations, and so far only these two populations, have been observed with these injuries. Laudrey notes that during springtime, many Kane Basin and East Greenland bears live on land-fast ice, extensive ice sheets that are attached to the shore, or at the foot of glaciers. Warming in these environments lead to a thinner sea ice, allowing seawater to seep up into the snow and create a slushy surface. And with that, we have run out of time. This article was titled, Polar Bears Live on Ice, But New Conditions Are Injuring Them, by Kieran Mulvaney. This has been the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your reader. The articles I've read were all published in October/November of 2024. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you've missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on demand. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.